I do hope you're having a good morning and a wonderful day, and I do hope that you're being blessed by just being with God's people and what we've done, and singing and praying, and it's just a privilege to be able to gather with God's people. If you are visiting, we are so proud to have you with us. If you would open your Bibles to Joshua chapter 10. Joshua chapter 10. For those of you who are visiting, we've been looking at Joshua on Sunday nights. The last few weeks, we've started looking at it a little bit on Sunday morning. Here, I guess after next week, we'll go back to just looking at it on Sunday nights. But our young folks are studying that for their Bible Bowl questions and so forth, related to Lads to Leaders, and that convention will be this next weekend, so I hope you'll be praying for them. In fact, I know several of our young folks who are in speech will be speaking in a couple of different adult classes this morning, so pray for them and all the adults who are working with them this weekend. But that's why we're looking at Joshua, and also I think Joshua fits well with our theme for this year of revival. Because what you're seeing in the book of Joshua is the revival of a promise God made to Abraham and his descendants, a promise that those descendants tried to throw away when they chose to listen to 10 spies instead of 2 who went in to spy out the land of Canaan. And those parents, that generation that didn't trust God, perished in the wilderness. And so what you have in Joshua is the promise being fulfilled in the lives of their children. And as we've journeyed through it, we've seen that God revives His promises. When God makes a promise, God keeps it. There was a movie that came out in 2008 called The Day the Earth Stood Still. I think it's a remake of a movie that came out in 1951. It just recently came out on DVD. I think Keanu Reeves maybe is the star in it. Don't know a lot about it. I've not seen the movie. I'm not recommending or not recommending. So you watch at your own discretion with guardedness. But all I want to say is interesting. Best I know is the movie is about basically aliens coming to Earth. And so they called it The Day the Earth Stood Still. Well, I want us to talk today about the day the earth stood still, not some made-up Hollywood movie, but the day the earth really did stand still. The day that God stopped the spinning of the earth to help His army defeat the enemy. We're looking today at Joshua chapter 10. As we look at Joshua chapter 10, I want us to kind of remind ourselves of what's going on. Look a little bit at the setting before we dive into the story. So look at the setting, we can go back to chapter 9, and what we've got here is what's going on in the story is we're going to look at today and tonight about the primary taking of the land of Canaan. This will allow us at the end of our 2 sermons, a sermon this morning, tonight we look at the Northern Alliance, we're going to see that at the end of the day, the taking of the land for the most part has taken place. Then we'll begin looking at what do they do once they've primarily got control of the land of Canaan. So we're going to look this morning at Joshua's battles in the southern part of the land of Canaan. Then tonight we'll look at his battles in the northern part of the land of Canaan. Because what he's been doing to this point is he's been cutting a swath right across the middle of the country, separating the kingdoms of the south from the kingdoms of the north. And you'll notice in what we look at today, the kingdoms from the south and north don't fight together. They've been cut off. The major kingdoms, or at least important strategic nations or kingdoms, I guess in this case, city-states in between the north and the south have already been taken by Israel. And so what's going to happen is the south is going to bind together and fight, and then the north is going to bind together and fight. But if we go back to Joshua chapter 9, we're going to remember that basically what is happening, you're going to see different reactions to what Israel is doing as they're taking the promised land. We talked about last Sunday night the deception, and we talked about how the people of Gibeon disguised themselves and made it look like they came from a great distance and made a peace treaty with Israel. They made a peace treaty by deception. Jason and I were talking about this week that in today's modern laws in the United States, the Israelites would not have had to honor that particular agreement under our laws because it was created by deception. And when you create an agreement by deception, then as I understand it, you'd have to ask Jason more about that. It would be null and void. But what we find, even though Gibeon used deception to create the treaty, Israel honored the treaty, and they did not kill the Gibeonites. But that treaty sets the stage for what happens in the rest of the book. And remember, basically, they were deceived because they went based on appearances. They looked at these people who came who had worn out clothing, worn out sandals, old, crusty, moldy bread. And they said, these folks have come from a long, long way off. They're not some of the neighbors that we're supposed to defeat. So they went based on appearances. And the text also says they never asked God. They didn't ask for God's input. And so because they went on appearances, they walked by sight instead of by faith. And because they didn't listen to God, they made a mistake, the leadership did, in striking a treaty with one of the kingdoms that they were supposed to be conquering. And so this puts them in a situation that is going to create more battles and warfare. And we're going to see how God works through this to do some amazing things. And remember, I've emphasized over and over that what you see in Joshua is you see a consistent pattern of how people react to when they hear about Israel. Over and over the text will say, and they heard, Rahab heard, the people of Jericho heard, the Gibeonites heard. And now today we're going to see what somebody else hears. In Joshua chapter 10 verse 1 it says, Now it came about when Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had captured Ai, and had utterly destroyed it, just as he had done to Jericho and its king, and so he had done to Ai and its king, and that the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel, and were within their land, that he feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, because it was greater than Ai, and all its men were mighty. Okay, remember, all of these nations are making decisions of what to do about what they're hearing about Israel. And what they're hearing, in many cases, goes back 40 years. Remember we talked about Rahab said, we've heard of how your God parted the Red Sea and gave you deliverance from Egypt. We've heard of what you did to the Amorite kings on the eastern side of the Jordan River. And now as they move their way into the Promised Land, they're beginning to hear about what they're doing in the Promised Land. The king of Jerusalem. And remember we talked about before that basically what you've got in the land of Canaan is you don't have one rulership over the whole region. Each separate, many of these, you had these larger cities that had their own king. And then there would be smaller little towns around them that would have allegiance to that one king. And many times these separate cities with their own kings would form alliances with each other. And you would have an alliance of city-states. The Philistines always functioned that way with five city-states in alliance. That they would, the alliance not only said they were at peace with each other, but it said they went to war with each other. When one was attacked, all defended. And so that's what they're dealing with as they go into the Promised Land. And so now these other city-states, these other mini-kingdoms, if you will, are hearing about what happened to the people of Jericho, what happened to the people of Ai. And they're all having to make decisions. Remember, Rahab heard of what God had done, and she chose to trust, put her trust in God. The rest of the people of her city did not, and they chose to stay behind their walls. Now, you're going to begin to see a change. When they went to Ai, the people of Ai didn't do like the people of Jericho. The people of Jericho tried to stay behind the safety of their wall. They didn't go out and attack Israel. God brought the wall down and Israel came in. So when we look at the two battles with the smaller city of Ai, they apparently came out of the city and attacked Israel. They took a different tactic. When Israel got close to the city, instead of staying behind their walls and trying to hold out and giving the God of Israel a chance to bring their walls down, they took the attack to Israel. And for one day, they were successful. And my suspicion is that emboldened some of the other nations. And so what's going to happen here is you have a change in strategy that takes place among the cities and kings of the land. They're no longer going to wait for Israel to get to them. They're no longer going to wait behind their city walls or even like Ai, fight them just outside their city walls. They are now going to join together multiple kings, multiple cities, and multiple armies, and they're going to take the attack to Israel. Again, they're all trying desperately to figure out a way to stop Israel from taking the land God has promised to them. And remember that God is giving this land to Israel because of the evil and the idol worship of the people that live in the land. So you're dealing with those people trying desperately to stop what God has promised and decreed. So in verse 3 it says, Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, sent word to Hoham, king of Hebron, to Piram, king of Jarmuth, to Japhiah, king of Lachish, and Deber, king of Eglon, saying, "Come up to me and help me, and let us attack Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and with the sons of Israel." So the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon, gathered together and went up, they with all their armies, and camped by Gibeon and fought against it. Let's kind of get a picture of what's going on here. Israel has come into the land of Canaan by crossing the Jordan River just above the Dead Sea. They have first attacked Jericho, then attacked Ai. They then went up into the region of Samaria, called a timeout, and worshipped and praised God. But they're now camped at Gilgal. There's a couple of locations that are put forth for that, and one of those is over close to Jericho. They've made peace with Gibeon. So kind of we can highlight there on the map, you see a couple of red splashes maybe that come up here, and that'll show you Jericho and Ai. Those are the two cities they've already destroyed. And you can see the little yellow arrow. That is pointing to Gibeon. And actually, the Gibeonites, there were four cities that were there together in cohort. You got one city called Gibeon, but there were actually four cities that the Israelites made peace with. And these people were the Hivite peoples. The group that is doing the attacking in this story are Amorite peoples. But apparently, the people of Gibeon had been in a peace treaty with these kings who are now about to attack them. And so what happens is, you've got five kings who are coming together. The king of Jerusalem is the leader of this group. And so he sends word to these four other cities and says, "Hey, get your armies together. The Gibeonites have made peace with Israel, and we've got to do something about this. If we don't stop this, then everybody's going to start making peace with Israel, and we're not going to have anybody to help us to fight them." Okay, this is a serious threat to their safety and security for a large and important city like Gibeon to make peace with the Israelites. And so what's going to happen is these are going to come together and they're going to try to attack, not Joshua first, they're going to attack Gibeon first. Now you begin to see how you have a kind of a domino effect that is taking place. Israel makes poor decisions. They choose to make a treaty with a neighbor that they're supposed to destroy because they go based on appearances and they don't listen to God. But they honor the treaty because they felt that's what they're supposed to do. So they honor the treaty. Because they honor the treaty with Gibeon and don't kill the Gibeonites, five kings band together and come to fight Gibeon. And so it's going to end up drawing them into that battle. They're not going to attack one city at a time. They're now going to fight the army of those five cities all at once. Look at verse 6. "Then the men of Gibeon sent word to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal, saying, 'Do not abandon your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us and help us, for all the kings of the Amorites that live in the hill country have assembled against us.' So Joshua went up to Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the valiant warriors. And the Lord said to Joshua, 'Do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. Not one of them shall stand against you.'" Now I want you to notice what's happening here. Remember that a peace treaty like Israel made with Gibeon didn't just mean they wouldn't kill the Gibeonites. It also meant that they would protect them if they were attacked by somebody else. The Gibeonites basically said, "In return for this peace treaty, we submit ourselves to you as your servants and slaves. We will be a vassal kingdom serving you." And so they, as we saw at the end of chapter 9, became woodcutters and water carriers for the people of Israel. That meant not only that they became servants, but that Israel then became responsible for them. As parents, we have dependent children that we're responsible for. Kingdoms had dependent kingdoms that they were responsible for. And so when they made this peace treaty, it's a double-edged sword. It goes both ways. It means not only will they let them live, it means they will keep other people from killing them. And so as soon as Gibeon is attacked by these five kingdoms, they send to Joshua and say, "Joshua, come and save us." And the Lord says to Joshua, "Go ahead, protect them. I'm going to take care of you." And so the battle ensues. One of the things that's fascinating is Joshua is a brilliant tactician. He is a brilliant strategist. He's a brilliant military leader. And what the text says is Joshua came upon them suddenly by marching all night from Gilgal. He didn't waste time, but apparently they marched all night. And I want you to imagine these armies. They're encamped at Gibeon. They're prepared to attack. And they wake up early in the morning to prepare for battle. And suddenly, out of the morning mist, they hear the marching footsteps of an approaching army. Apparently, they are caught totally by surprise. They never dreamed, apparently, that Israel would do what Israel did. They march all night, and it says in verse 10, "And the Lord confounded them before Israel, and He slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon." If you go down to verse 11, it says that they fled from before Israel while they were in the descent of Beth-horon. The Lord threw large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than those whom the sons of Israel killed with a sword. Now, has anybody ever been in a storm and had hail fall on them? Anybody had this happen before? I remember being in a couple of tornadoes in my lifetime, and one I remember was April 3rd, 1974. If you lived in the state of Kentucky on April 3rd, you knew all about tornadoes. They came not once, not twice, but tornado after tornado after tornado. Basically, wiped, for the most part, the city of Brandenburg, Kentucky, almost off the map. And I can remember that day, a friend of mine was over, and we'd just been out riding our bikes, and we came back, and I don't remember what we were playing downstairs. We had a tri-level in our house at that time. We were downstairs, and we noticed the sky began to change outside. And we also began to hear the rattling of the windows. And of course, as young boys, we were just fascinated with this. And so we walked to the door to watch things fly around. And I can remember watching the car kind of moving back and forth. I remember the thing that broke my heart about the whole day was it took down my basketball goal. I remember staring at it, and in Kentucky, you couldn't live in Kentucky unless you had a basketball goal in your driveway. And I remember it just whoom. And then I knew things were serious when the basketball goals start coming down. But what I also remember was the incredible thudding and crashing sound of the hail. I can remember one that went through the storm door on the back door of our house. I mean, this is a pretty stout storm door, and it just busted through it. When it was over, we went out and found we had hail stones in the yard that were between the size of a baseball and approaching the size of a women's softball. I remember I kept some of those in our freezer for a long time. We had to reshingle our whole house, had to redo the aluminum siding on the house. Anything that wasn't under something was basically busted all to pieces. And I can still right now, I can hear the smashing glass. I can hear the thudding on the roof. I want us to understand, you know, when I look at this story, the thought of being out in an open field when huge hailstones are falling down from the sky is nothing short of terrifying. And I want you to imagine you've got these kings. Israel has them on the run. So you've got the Israelite army that has totally taken them by surprise on one side. And as they're fleeing from them, they're fleeing into a hailstorm. I mean, you're talking about out of the frying pan, into the fire kind of stuff. God is overwhelming them with His power and His might. And the swords of Israel are the weaponry of Israel, and the hailstones of God would have been devastating. I want you to realize what these soldiers are trying to do. They have left their fortified cities and are have gone to take the attack to Gibeon and ultimately to thwart the work of Israel. Now the battle is lost and all they are trying to do is survive. The key to survival is to get back to their fortified cities. Remember those five fortified cities we looked at on the map? They're trying to get to one of those cities or the closest city they can get to, just survive it, then regroup and figure out what they're going to do next. Joshua recognizes he's got them on the run. And so what he needs to do is not let these armies get back inside their city walls, or we're going to have to, you know, have a siege or have a Jericho or something else is going to have to happen to deal with these armies. They're still a threat, and Israel still has the responsibility of conquering them. So Joshua doesn't want them to get back to their cities. He doesn't want them to be able to hide in the cover of darkness. So in verse 12, "Then Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the sons of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, O sun, stand still at Gibeon, O moon in the valley of Aijalon. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged themselves of their enemies." And I want to talk for just a few moments about what's going on here. First of all, I think this text is a reminder that we need to be very careful about what we call pre-science in the Bible. By pre-science, at least as I understand it, is the idea that people knew things about the world in a period before it was scientifically discovered by human beings. In other words, you find yourself saying, how did they know that then? Now let me say, I believe there's evidence of that in the Bible. I believe there are some places we can go to in the Bible where people knew things before it had been scientifically discovered, and you find yourself saying, how did they know that? And it can point to the fact that maybe there is a divine being behind the Bible, which is what I firmly believe. But having said that, I believe there is pre-science, if you will, in the Bible. I also believe you have to be very, very careful about identifying that and overemphasizing that. Because you also have to remember in the Bible is a book that's written for common people to help them understand God, and it's often written from their perspective. You may have in Job it talking about the circle of the earth, but then you may turn around somewhere else and talk about the four corners of the earth. I do think it's significant that it mentions that there was a circle of the earth. How did they come to that thought and understanding? I think that's worth noting. But I also have to recognize that the Bible is a poetic book, and poetic language isn't typically scientific language. And it's also written from the perspective of people on earth. And I want you to think about even how we are today. You know, when I went to Arizona, I wanted to see some sunrises and some sunsets. Did you hear what I just said? Let me ask you, does the sun rise? Does the sun set? Does the sun move? Okay, I want you to think about when I went to a website, okay? I went to some scientific websites and I wanted to find out when was sunrise, when was sunset in different parts of Arizona. So when I'm at the canyon, I know when I can expect sunset. I wanted to know when I'm at Monument Valley, when is sunrise. Now, when I went to those places, it did not say at 6:35 on Saturday morning, the earth will tilt just enough that you can begin to see the rays of the sun over the horizon. That's not what it said. It said at 6:35 a.m. you're going to have sunrise. Okay, that's no different from how they described things and said things in the Bible. Need to understand then that mixed in with maybe some scientific insight that comes early, if you will, there are also expressions that describe things from the perspective of how people see it. So did the sun stand still? Did the moon stand still? Well, as I understand it, not being a scientist, but as I understand it, the earth is what had to stand still for the sun and the moon to be still in the sky. What happened here? Did the earth stand still for a time? Did God delay what we call the setting of the sun by stopping the earth? And we understand that there would be many repercussions on the earth and throughout, I think even the solar system, to that happening. Other people believe that maybe it was just a cloud. Others believe it was a mirage. Others believe it was an eclipse. Some of this has to do with deciding how that you translate some of these words. Some think it was a mirage, kind of where you had a miraculous refraction of the sun's rays, so it looked like the sun stayed up longer. Others believe that what Josh was asking for was not for the sun to stay in the sky, but a break from the sun's heat, and that so that you might have significant cloud cover, or you might have had an eclipse, and all kinds of things. And so you got all. It's fascinating to me when you're reading through commentaries, and these are commentaries written by people who say they believe in God and believe in the Bible, and they're all struggling with the idea that God could have actually made the earth stand still, because they feel like that's just too big, that's too grand, that's too many things that have to happen, too many repercussions. So surely there must have been something else that really happened. Well, let me say, I believe God made the earth stand still. So you kind of know where my perspective is. But here's the real point. The real point is, what did God do? God helped His people. When His people were in battle, God said, "I will give the victory, and no one will be able to stand for you, before you." And He sent hail, and He stilled the earth to give Israel the victory. Now what's interesting is, we go on reading the story, you're going to find out that the five kings who instigated all of this end up going to hide in a cave. And fascinating what happens, and we'll talk a little bit more about Joshua's leadership techniques tonight. But what Joshua does is, he hears the five kings are in a cave, and this is a big deal. Because if he takes down the kings, this is significant. But he also knows he's got the enemy on the run, and he doesn't want to stop chasing the army of the kings to get the kings. So he says to his soldiers, "I want you to put rocks in front of the opening of the cave, keep the kings in the cave, put a guard over it, and then you send the army to chase their armies, because the real threat comes from their armies." And then once they had done all they could do with the armies and came back to camp, then they opened up the cave and they took out the kings. And the text says that the kings were made to lie prostrate before Joshua, and Joshua had his commanders one by one come up and place their foot on the neck of the king. That was a common thing done in warfare in the ancient world. It was a sign of victory. It was a sign of submission. And he basically is saying to those commanders, God is going to do this to all of your enemies. If you will trust the Lord and you'll be faithful to the Lord, God is going to lay them down literally before you. And in accordance with God's commands, those kings were put to death, and the battle rages onward. And what they begin to do then after that is, first of all, you've got the cave at Makeda where the five kings hid. They capture and kill the kings. They capture and control the local city. And then as you look at the map here, systematically what they're going to do, remember, you've got these five city-states, these five kingdoms who've gone to war. After they've captured Makeda and that city and killed the kings in the cave, then they start attacking the nearby cities. And three of the five cities involved in the attack on Gibeon, in this five-city alliance, are taken down. Now we know that Jarmuth and Jerusalem are controlled. In fact, later when they divide up the kingdom, they give Jarmuth to, I think, the tribe of Judah, best I remember. But it's David who would eventually, years later, finally take the city of Jerusalem. But three of those cities and many neighboring cities are taken down. Even Gezer, which is up kind of towards the middle of the country, sends an army down to help Lachish when they're being attacked. And they are defeated as well. But now remember now, when they go to fight these cities now, their armies are basically decimated. They wiped out their armies for the most part on the battlefield. And now their cities are easier to take down. And so because of this chain of events, Israel defeats the southern part of the land of Canaan. Now what's the significance of all this to us? We've looked at the setting, kind of the events that led up to it. We've walked through the story. But what can we learn from it? What are some lessons we can take home? I think the first thing we need to remember is that God can do anything. I understand that it is a major thing for the earth to stand still. I understand there is a great deal involved in that. And maybe I just come from too simplistic a perspective. But if God can make the earth, if God can make the sun, can make the moon, can make the universe, if we begin with that basic belief system, then why can't He stop or slow down its spinning? Why can't He decide for a while to lengthen a day? Now, I've heard the reports, and maybe Hugh as well, you probably got it in an email somewhere saying that NASA somewhere down along through time did this study of light and how it's cast and how long it takes to get places, and they've discovered a missing day. I can find no credible information to back up that assertion. It's just kind of one of those things that somebody started and floats around on the internet. But I do believe God lengthened a day. Not because of some made-up story that circulates on the web, but because of my Bible. The same Bible that says God made the world said God made the earth stand still. When are we going to stop limiting our God? Oh, He can do this much. He can send down some hailstones, but He can't do this. Who said? There is no limit to our God. And until we learn to live with that, we're going to live a limited, scared, frustrated life. When I wake up with a God who can do a little bit, who can't do everything, then I'm going to wake up living with worry and frustration. But if I can wake up with a God who can do anything except deny His very nature, then it transforms the way I live. But He can not only do anything, He can use anything. Again, Jason Golden and I were talking last week after Sunday night's sermon, and we were talking about the fact that isn't it interesting that even though Israel did the wrong thing in that treaty they made with Gibeon, even though they went based on appearances and they didn't listen to God and they made a treaty they shouldn't have made, God ended up using that treaty to further His cause. That treaty forced these five kings and their armies outside their city walls. It gathered them together in one place. So that instead of Israel having to chase them down city by city, Israel was able to attack them at one time in one place. God was able, as they ran from that battlefield, to send down hailstones from heaven to lengthen the day. And then when they got to the cities where those armies came from, the city was weakened. Because the king was dead, they did not have their leader, and their army was decimated. In other words, God was even able to make a mistake by Israel and use it to His glory. Maybe you've made a mistake in your life. I know my life is filled with them. Maybe there's something you've done that haunts you and it breaks your heart. I want you to realize that if you'll, like Israel, admit that mistake, put your trust back in God and live to do His will, that He can, even out of that mistake, can work good things for His name and His glory. Because my God can use anything. And my God can see anything. Those kings had used their might, their combined might. They did what nobody in the land of Canaan had done. They bound together and said, together with this great army, we'll defeat Israel. God frustrated them and sent them in flight. And so finally you end up with these five powerful kings hiding in a cave. But you see, you can never not only hide, you cannot hide from God's army, but ultimately you cannot hide from God. How many of us are hiding from God in a cave? How many of us are hiding something from God's people, from our spouses, from our children? Things that we are doing in secret that are a violation of God's will and our relationship with Him and our relationship maybe with others. We need to understand that if God can find five kings in a cave in southern Canaan, then He knows what I'm hiding in my cave. Would you take out your psalm books and turn to the hymn of encouragement? I have been told that the sun has been quieter of late, that you have a trend that started in 2007, and that trend is that you're having fewer sunspots and lower magnetic fields. This benefits us in a lot of different ways. It lessens certain amounts of radiation waves that are coming on Earth. My understanding, it helps our GPSs work better. It helps our satellites work better. I'm told it even can be a benefit in helping with what is called global warming. In other words, every once in a while, historically, the sun goes through a down period where it's not quite as magnetic and not quite as tumultuous. And generally, that lasts about 5 years. And they say we're in the middle of one of those. But as we think about a time when the sun calms down, if you will, and that benefits humanity, I want you to think of what we're talking about today, a time when the sun didn't calm down, but the sun's influence was extended for a day as a sign that God was helping His people. God didn't retire from helping His people at the end of this battle. God still helps His people. I don't expect today to be any longer than yesterday. But I do expect God to be there. And I do believe God can still do wondrous and miraculous things. If you would like to live a renewed life, then the life that God offers is what you're looking for. If you would like to wake up every day knowing no matter what the economy goes through, no matter what the world goes through, whether it's war or peace, you live every day with a God that can still the earth and made the sun, then it is my prayer, if you've never accepted Christ, that you'll express your faith in repentance, confession, and baptism, put on Christ, accept Him as your King, as your Lord, and your God, the one who has no limits, and live like you've never lived before. And for those of us who are Christians, let's stop hiding our evil in our caves, and let's acknowledge what we've done, make it right with God, and let's start living in trust and quit living in fear, because the God who stilled the earth is still bringing calm to the lives of His people. That is the God we worship and who awaits us as we stand and sing.